Ark Raiders, a multiplayer extraction adventure game where most of humanity shelters underground. But raiders rise to the surface in search of something greater. In the Rust Belt, danger isn't the end of the story. It's the beginning of the adventure. Every journey above ground is a gamble against the relentless machines of Ark and rival raiders chasing the same dream. Explore a lethal yet vibrant world scarred by old conflicts and reclaimed by nature, where shifting conditions make every high-stakes run unpredictable. Ark Raiders. Available now on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X, S, and PC. Rated T for Teen.
I'm caught up in the game. My attention is on every play and every whistle. But what I'm missing is a signal coming from my kidneys. That signal isn't like a ref's whistle. It's more of a silent SOS, which could be warning me of an increased risk for events like heart attack or stroke. And a way I can catch that signal? A simple urine test called UACR. If you have type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure, talk to your doctor about the UACR test. Detect the SOS. Visit detectthesos.com to learn more.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You think you understand how this business works, but you don't.
Landman, TV's biggest phenomenon, returns to Paramount Plus. From Taylor Sheridan, co-creator of Yellowstone, starring Billy Bob Thornton.
You have to know the rules of the game and bend them. And you really have to know them to break them.
Demi Moore.
I want success. Get it for me.
Andy Garcia, Ali Larter, and Sam Elliott.
You don't even know the game you're playing, do you?
Landman, new season, streaming November 16th, only on Paramount Plus.
Cool, but not as cold as it has been. 47 degrees right now if you average the temperatures throughout the area. And then looking ahead to the rest of the day, highs today about 75. Same for tomorrow and Friday, Saturday, a little bit warmer. Sunday, a little bit warmer still. Highs near 80 and 81. Hard to believe after a freeze the night before last. But that's the way it's going to be here in November. You know that. And then by Thursday of next week, they're saying a chance for showers and maybe a little reinforcing cool front, but not much. So you can look for highs in the mid-70s near 80 for the foreseeable future. Robert Hogan joins us now. Dr. Robert Hogan, professor and department chair of political science at LSU. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Let's talk about the government shutdown. First of all, where does it stand?
Well, it appears right now that the government is likely to open back up. The Senate on Monday evening voted to open the government. There were 8 Democratic senators who relented to the Republicans' demands that allowed a vote to occur by 60-40 vote over the filibuster threshold. And it's now up to the House of Representatives that is heading back into town right now. And there should be a vote later today by the House of Representatives. Mike Johnson has said that he expects for the House Republicans to be very supportive of this deal. Democrats have been very strident in their opposition to it. But if it passes, it does have Trump's backing. He said he supports it and wants to sign it. And generally these days for Republicans, whatever Trump wants, he gets with the Republican Party. So it seems very likely to pass, and the president will sign it, and this impasse will be over, and the government shutdown should end. So that's sort of where we are right now.
What did the Democrats gain from all of this?
Yeah, that's a question that a lot of them are asking, a lot of political observers are asking. I mean, some people say that the Democrats gained nothing. They had wanted an extension of the ACA subsidies. They did not get that at all. The only thing they got from the Senate leader, Mr. Thune, is an assurance that it would be brought up for a vote sometime in December. And in order to pass, it would need to get 60 votes. And there's this very unlikely that any Republicans would support this. So you could say the Democrats came up with nothing. From another perspective, a lot of Democrats are saying that, well, you know, people, the Democratic activists especially, wanted Democrats to fight the president and to show that they cared about an issue that is something that affects the American people, and that are rising health care costs. Affordability is an issue that resonates with the American public right now, as seen in last week's elections. And this was a way for them to highlight that issue. In fact, I think to show that this is resonating, you've seen Trump himself come up with his own plan, taking a plan out of bags, and no one's really clear about what it is, to address affordability of health care. So, you know, it's something that resonates, I think, certainly with their base, and they're hoping that it resonates with the American public and may have an effect on next year's midterm election.
Yeah, because he said rather than give it to, and I'm paraphrasing here, rather than give it to greedy insurance companies, he wanted to give it to individuals, but the individuals would be getting
buy insurance.
Taxpayers' money to buy insurance from the greedy insurance companies, right?
Right. It's not very clear at all about, this is often the way policies are created and sort of evolve from the Trump administration. Trump has an idea, and later on some meat gets put on the bone, so to speak, and something comes of it. This has been an effective way for Trump to certainly have an effect on the policy agenda, the sort of issues that we're talking about. So we'll just have to see what happens with that. But it does demonstrate, I think, that this hit a chord with the American public. The other thing that it did for the Democrats in terms of a positive way for their side is that it brought out in the open what the Trump administration was willing to do with regard to SNAP benefits. The Trump administration went time and time again to courts trying to get the courts to agree with them so that they would not have to pay SNAP benefits during this government shutdown. And again, I think that is something the Democrats want to highlight to their base of support and to independent voters as well, demonstrating that when the stakes are high, the Trump administration is not on the side of the American people. At least that's the way they're trying to spin it. So we'll have to see how this plays out. It's a very long way to November of next year, and who knows what the issues will be that people will be talking about. It's probably unlikely that people will remember a lot of what's going on now. But what is important right now for the midterm elections are candidates who are thinking of running for office. And there are a lot of candidates across the country right now, potential candidates, thinking of throwing their hat in the ring. And if they view this as an election, the 2026 election is one in which Democrats may have an upper hand. You may see more quality candidates with experience and good financial backing to run, to be good candidates. And so you may have this may be affecting the candidate pool of people who are going to run.
Yeah, that was my next question about what can we infer from the elections. But that's interesting that it could be a positive thing for potential Democrats, because we hear about, you know, the bench not being very deep, that perhaps this could surface some people that would be willing to run and think they have a chance that otherwise would not have.
Exactly. But of course, you know, in this polarized environment that we have, I mean, generally when you have a midterm election like this after a presidential election in 2024, in which Trump did very well, extraordinarily well, in sweeping the swing states, and he came in with some coattails to some extent, and, you know, the Republican Party holds both chambers of the Congress. That sort of in the high turnout election, you expect in the midterms, just in general, there is less enthusiasm because the person at the top of the ticket, Trump, is not going to be on the ticket. A lot of people are not going to turn out to vote who supported him. And so there's a slump for the party that won all that initially in the midterms. So we would expect for there to be you know, Republicans not doing as well in the upcoming midterm elections.
All right, let me take a break, and, Professor. We'll pick it up right there when we come back. 6:21, time for traffic, WWL. 6:26, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about the government shutdown and who's going to eat the blame for it with Dr. Robert Hogan, Professor, Department Chair of Political Science at LSU. Professor, I hated to interrupt you, but time and traffic and tide wait for no man. So what were you saying? I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's fine. No, I was just saying that, I mean, the midterms are shaping up to, I mean, in general, midterm elections for the president's party generally are not favorable to them. And so, you know, the Republicans hold just a slim majority in the House of Representatives and not a very good majority in the Senate. And so I think the general expectation is that the Republicans, you know, in this, you know, given these circumstances, have the potential to lose seats and to lose the House of Representatives. And because of that, however, I think the Trump administration, what's motivating their, that has motivated their redistricting efforts across the country, this redistricting war that's sweeping the country, starting with Texas, Trump convincing Texas to redistrict in the middle of redistricting, you know, at a time they don't normally redistrict. Normally you do this after each census, but they did it. They're doing it in the middle of the this census cycle or of this cycle, and they withdrew districts that they hope will win them five extra congressional seats in Texas, and of course that spurred California and Gavin Newsom to redistrict in California, and that was one of the big wins for Democrats last Tuesday night. Was California deciding to set aside the redistricting commission, the nonpartisan redistricting commission, and allowing the state legislature to redistrict in a partisan way, hoping that they will get five extra seats. So this is sort of sweeping the country right now, and Republicans initiated this. Trump initiated this. As a way of hoping to forestall the typical sort of pattern that we see in midterm elections, where the president's party loses seats in the House of Representatives. But it also comes down to how the economy is going to go, and the gamble that the Trump people have made is with tariffs and other sort of things. They're hoping that the economy will not be sputtering this time next year, but will be zooming. And that is something that's usually very important in voters' minds. Also, of course, the popularity of the president, which is oftentimes a result of how the economy is going. So I guess all this was to say that there are a lot of variables out there. The conditions just generally don't favor the Republicans in next year's elections, although the major caveat is the redistricting battle that is ongoing in the country. Whoever wins that battle probably has an upper hand in the 2026 elections.
One constant is the president is not going to change. He is who he is. I don't think he's ever going to lose his 38%. So
right.
What part of the electorate changes then? It's the part that's not his 38% that will then vote based on the economy or whomever the Republican mm-hmm. nominee happens to be?
Yeah, it's voters who are sort of in the middle. We call them independent voters, voters who don't like either major party, but who base their votes not on partisan affiliation, but on just how things are going in the country. And if things are going well, they're going to go with the president's party. If things aren't, they're not. So a lot of it comes down to those people who are not as, caught up in the day-to-day politics that so many others of us are.
Yeah, I know some people that were just watching the elections last week as though it were the Super Bowl, and I'm thinking, it's not even the midterms. Can you take a breath?
A form of entertainment.
It is. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Dr. Robert Hogan, Professor and Department Chair of Political Science at LSU. We'll talk about the air traffic controller shortage when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 6:45, quarter till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Melanie Dickman, a lecturer at the Center for Aviation Studies at The Ohio State University, a three-time graduate from The Ohio State University. Good morning, Melanie. How are you?
I'm great this morning. How are you?
I'm well. Is it Dr. Dickman, or is it?
It is not. You can just call me Melanie.
All right, Melanie, let me ask you this. You're a three-time graduate of The Ohio State University?
I sure am.
I would think you'd know the words of the fight song then?
Yeah.
Can I hear a little bitty bit of it, please? Just a little bitty bit.
Oh, gosh, not in public.
Okay. All right, just thought I'd ask. Let's talk about air traffic controllers. You are...
Yeah, it's always worth an ask.
You are, huh?
It is always worth an ask.
Yeah, you never know. You never know what people are going to do. Tell me about what the situation is with air traffic controllers in the country.
Oh, gosh. Do you have a few hours?
I do. Absolutely. I'll clear the schedule till 10 o'clock if you like, Melanie, for you. But at the end of it, you're going to have to sing the fight song.
Oh, yeah. Then I won't take up all your time.
Okay.
So we'll just keep it to the allotted time. Then.
All right. Tell me seriously, what's going on with air traffic controllers?
There is a lot going on with air traffic controllers right now. So where do you want me to start with that?
Well, let's talk about the current situation and the government shutdown and work back from there.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah, the government shutdown is definitely impacting them so much. As you know, it's air traffic control is one of the most high-stress jobs that you can possibly have. And they're responsible for so many lives. They're responsible for keeping everybody safe in the skies. And right now, they're showing up and not getting paid to do that. So they're looking at their third missed paycheck right now of just $0. So they get the pay stub and everything, and it just says zero. And they're expected right now to be keeping track of their own hours that they worked. And eventually... they're supposed to get back pay, but it's not going to be immediate, unfortunately. So these controllers still have bills to pay. Back pay really doesn't help pay the mortgage. It doesn't pay off the credit cards. And then when you're looking at, hey, there's a big lag in between when you're working and when you're getting paid, you're still going to have to be responsible for the interest on that you're missing. So inevitably, they're going to come out behind.
If an air traffic controller were, and you know, you train these people and so forth, and you lecture in this, if they were to leave to get another job, what would they do? What would be a good fit for an air traffic controller?
There are actually a lot of them doing just that. So they normally see, on just an average year, they're going to see about 4 or 5 retirements a day. And that's just when controllers...
That's
just when they're hitting the mandatory retirement age.
Which is?
So, you know, I think there's 56.
Okay. And that's because of, let me interrupt for a second, if I can, Melanie, and that's because they feel as though at 56 people lose the cognitive function that they need to be an effective air traffic controller, or because of time on the job? Tell me where that number came from.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a lot of different things. The original studies were saying that, yes, you do lose some of the reaction time, the cognitive abilities. It's just difficult to do the job. But honestly, also, most of the controllers are ready to retire at that point anyway. Mm-hmm. It's the job itself is so intense. And so they're ready. So you've got that mandatory age that you've got to be out. Now, some of them go into consulting, some of them go back into management of some sort, so they're not really retiring, they're just retiring from being on position.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't really help the workforce who has to work the traffic. And then you have people who have put in their 30 years or so and said, you know what, I'm ready to retire, I'm eligible, and I'm going to go. But so you've got those two groups, but now you have a third and fourth group who that third group is these mid-level career air traffic controllers who are saying, you know what, pay has been an issue for a while now. Our raises have not even remotely kept up with inflation, and I can go get paid somewhere else for fewer hours, a better quality of life. I'm going to be able to go see my kids and their dance recitals and their soccer games. And I'm not going to have to work these 60-hour weeks. You know, they're working 10 hours a day, 6 days a week.
This is normally, or with the government? Normally, or with the government shutdown?
Oh, no, this is normal.
Let me take a break. I want to pick it up right there. I want to talk about hours, quality of life, and what kind of remuneration they get, because a lot of people think, I believe, that air traffic controllers are independently wealthy, and I don't think that's the case at all. We're talking to Melanie Dickman.
That's absolutely not the case.
All right, we'll pick it up when we come back. Lecture at the Center for Aviation Studies at The Ohio State University, 650, 10 till 7, Traffic Now, WWL. When was the last time you had your air conditioning ducts cleaned? If, like me, the house was built in 1993, I'm guessing the answer is never. I have never had mine clean, and the people from Gulf State Services are going to come out next week and clean them for me, take some pictures first and show me what's in there, and I'm sure I'm going to be disgusted. If you could see what's in there, layers of dust, mold, dead bugs, maybe even some rodent droppings, you would be disgusted as well. And we're breathing that in every day, even while we eat and sleep, and it can make us feel tired and run down, and we blame it on allergies, but maybe it's because we got filthy ducts. Your air ducts and whole air conditioning system should be cleaned out every 3 to 5 years, but again, if you're like me, the answer is never. It's never been cleaned out. You're breathing all that stuff in every day, so if you or your family members are always finding yourselves feeling run down or sick, or maybe every time the air comes on you don't feel right, why don't you call Gulf States Services? Locally owned, the number one trusted name in duct cleaning, mold remediation, and water damage restoration from Louisiana to the Florida Panhandle. Call Marcus. You're going to like doing business with them. Locally owned, locally operated, a family business. Gulf States Services LLC.com. That's the website. You can go to 504-944, or call them rather, at 504-944-3003. Gulf States Services Group LLC, professional duct cleaning and mold removal for a safer, healthier home. Call Marcus. You can love doing business with them. Gulf States Services LLC.com, or call 504-944-3003. Well, you don't have to sing it, but we'll play it for you, the Ohio State University fight song. Melanie Dickman, our guest, lecturer at the Center for Aviation Studies at The Ohio State University. We're talking about the life of an air traffic controller, quality of life, how much they get paid, the hours, et cetera. What is that like, Melanie, for people that, A, either are thinking about going into it, or B, might have a misconception about what it's really like?
So, yeah, that's a really great question. The controllers I know, and it's really important for people to understand that out of all of the controllers I've spoken to, my dad was one of them, my husband's one of them, they love their job. They love what they do. They're professionals. They got into it for a reason. So they really, really want to do a good job, and they really need to get paid to do this job. But they are really chronically understaffed, so that just really becomes an issue.
And what kind of hours are they working? What kind of money are they making?
So it really depends on the facility. So the busier the facility, the higher the level, it goes up to a level 12. Those are the controllers getting paid the most. The problem with how this is structured right now is that they're also some of the more expensive areas to live in. So, for example, I was talking to one controller this morning, and this controller was mentioning how they can't even afford to live in the city that they're controlling in. Mm. So this particular controller commutes 50 miles one way to go work, and then coming back, and, you know, obviously another 50 miles, the median home price in this area, if this controller were to have to go to work or have to, you know, live in it where they work, is median home price is like $800,000 for a house. Mm. This controller is making about $115,000 gross,
yeah. Which is not, yeah. I don't know, for people making $30,000 a year, that seems like a lot of money, but really it isn't. When it comes to a long shift, a 50-mile drive, mm-hmm. you said? A long shift and then a 50-mile drive home. Boy, that's tough.
Right, and then filling up their tank with gas, it's, you know, over $4 a gallon. So These really, really aren't wealthy people.
Scale of 1 to 10, now, how concerned are you about the future of air traffic controllers?
I'm fairly concerned. I mean, each time something like this happens, we just lose so many more controllers.
Wow.
So when I was saying that on a regular day, we're getting about five retirements a day, just regular retirements. But now we're seeing the people who are, like I said, you know, they've been in it for about 10 years, and they're saying, to hell with this, I can do something else.
Tipping point. Thank you. I appreciate your time, as always. Melanie Dickman, we'll take a break, come back, talk about, is it better to rent or buy a home? Is it better to rent or to buy? Let's talk to Alex Gailey, a bank rate data analyst, to see what the numbers show in 50 biggest metros in the United States. Good morning, Alex. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. Thank you for having me here.
I was always taught as a kid, and I tried to pass a message along to my kid, to buy as little car as you get by with, but something good, dependable. You know, you don't want to have a clunker, but to really put the money into the house if you can, because you'll get that back. Am I off base there? Have things changed? Tell me what the numbers show.
I don't think you're completely off base there. I still think that the long-term benefits of owning still are there, but the reality is that the barriers to enter home ownership have risen so much so that the math has just completely changed, especially in the last few years. I mean, if you looked at about a decade ago and did the math, you would find that in most parts of the country, it was actually pretty comparable, that monthly payment, if you looked at your mortgage and compared it to rent. Nowadays, we're not seeing that. And so what we found in our data is that in the 50 largest metros, that monthly mortgage payment is a lot higher than rent. And this is, of course, more of a short-term take, but it's important to note because, you know, a lot of people do want to own homes, but they're just facing these high home prices, they're facing these high mortgage rates, and it is harder to break into.
So it's not as much about long-term strategy, if I'm hearing you correctly, it's about what you can feasibly do at the moment.
Yeah, I think we have to take into account the reality that we're living in, which is that a lot of Americans still want to become homeowners, but unfortunately they are being priced out, or that it is taking longer for them to save for that down payment. And that is really just because if you look over the last 5 years, home prices have risen 40-50% across the country. We had those low mortgage rates during COVID, but then around 2022, we saw those mortgage rates jump up, and they've really stayed elevated around 6%. And then we can't ignore the fact that we've been in a supply crunch for a long time now, really since the Great Recession. We haven't been building enough homes. And so you combine all these things and you have a housing market really broadly across the country that is difficult for people to break into. Of course, real estate is local and it is going to be easier in parts of the South and you know, parts of the Midwest, and even we're seeing now parts of the West where home prices have come down, and it's going to be a little easier to buy in certain parts of the country, of course.
One thing that I always wondered about was, it seems as though people have X amount to pay for housing, and if the interest rates go down, well, then for whatever reason, the price of the house goes up. If the interest rates go up, then the price of the house goes down. Either way, people are still out of pocket the same amount. Am I wrong there or not?
No, you're not wrong there. I mean, certainly when mortgage rates fall, demand does tend to go up. And I would say generally this past year, the housing market has seen somewhat of a cooling or stagnation just because of the continued high home prices, of the continued high mortgage rates. And a lot of markets have kind of shifted more in favor of buyers, and some markets are even seeing some home prices fall. But I would say though that generally, you know, it's not enough to make buying truly affordable again. I describe it as the housing market as a whole just being a little bit more favorable for mm-hmm. buyers than maybe it was a year or two ago. And you also have to look at the rent side of this. You know, rent growth has certainly cooled across the country. There are places where you're maybe seeing very modest price growth in terms of rent, or you're not really seeing it at all. And so, again, buying in the long term is a very smart financial decision. Again, very broadly speaking here, but in the short term, Americans just feel very crunched to be able to enter homeownership.
Somebody texted in here, and I don't know if this is in your wheelhouse or not, Alex, but they said they were 20 years old, 20-something in the 70s, and bought a house, and it was at 13.5%. And they're wondering how people could afford to buy a house at 13.5% interest, but they can't afford to buy it at 7% interest.
Well, I think that's only taking part of the equation into account. You have to take in home price. So I'd be curious to know what they bought that home at in terms of price. But I will say that it's interesting that you bring up that they were 20 years old, because we recently saw with data that the median age of first-time homebuyers hit an all-time high of 40, and that is up from 38 last year. So we are seeing that median age for a first-time homebuyer is going up, and I think a lot of it we can blame the housing affordability crisis for that. And you know, again, people still want to buy homes, but they're just doing it a lot later in life than historically speaking.
Where did this affordability crisis come? Is there a tipping point where we can come to where look back and see where it changed?
I think certainly the 2022 mark, that was a big time where things really shifted. When you look at back when mortgage rates were really low during the pandemic, demand really spiked at that point because you had these historically low mortgage rates and people wanted to get in the market. And again, we've really not been building since the Great Recession. And so supply was already constrained. And so you saw these insane bidding wars, people just, you know, passing up, they weren't doing their inspections, they were doing anything to get the house. And 2022 is really when we started to see the housing affordability crisis get worse, because then we saw home prices not only rising at the rate they were, but also mortgage rates then really went up significantly. And so combine those two things, and then also just in the background, knowing supply is already constrained, and then you kind of end up where we are today.
I want to ask about the housing bubble when we come back and the effect that that had. We're talking to Alex Gailey, a Bankrate data analyst. Text me at 504-260-1870. What do you tell your kids? What did your parents tell you? Is it better to rent or buy? And if you have kids, grown kids, are they able to buy a home, or did you have to help them out? And if you are a grown kid, did you buy a home? At what age did you buy a home? Are you trying to get into the market? Is it just too tough? I'd like to hear your story at 504-260-1870, 720, traffic now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Alex Gailey, Bankrate data analyst, about renting as opposed to buying in the 50 biggest metro areas. I had a question, Alex, about the 2008 housing bubble, the crash. Did that necessarily leave a bad taste in people's mouths when, in fact, they were kind of being approved for mortgages that they never should have had in the first place?
Well, we know that was the the housing bubble was the primary cause of the Great Recession, and a lot of people really suffered from that recession. And certainly after the recession, there was a lot of stalling when it came to wanting to build homes and to keep, you know, builders just were feeling uneasy about that. And so really, when you think about the housing supply constraint today, it is connected to the Great Recession. And, you know, of course, people are wondering, you know, are we in a housing bubble now? And industry experts overwhelmingly agree that we're not, and that a crash is unlikely in the near future. You know, while home prices are high and affordability is a major challenge, the current conditions are structurally different now than they were back then. And we have much stricter lending standards, and we just have a fundamental lack of housing supply.
So why the fundamental lack of supply? That's what I'm trying to get my mind around. Why, if there's, is there not the demand for that? Because if there's a lack of supply, you would think there'd be the demand. So why aren't people building homes? Or is it because nobody can afford them?
Yeah, that's a great, I mean, it's a great point. A lot of it is tied to policy and how easy it is to build homes. It's really been hindered since the Great Recession due to a labor shortage, just increased material costs, tighter lending standards, and just broader consolidation in the home building industry. But certainly, I would say local policy has not made it easy to build. Depending on where you live, there are certainly parts of the country where zoning and regulation, there's a lot of red tape around being able to build more homes. So that's also part of this equation as well.
So if I were to make you the housing czar, how would you fix it?
I'm sorry?
If I were to make you the housing czar, how would you fix it?
I don't know if I'm the best person to answer that. I'm not a policy expert at the end of the day, but I would, one I have heard from economists and experts that I've spoken to about this topic is that really the biggest solution to a lot of this is building more homes and building more affordable homes specifically. And then in addition to that, building different types of homes. So, you know, nowadays, you know, there are lots of different ways that you can build homes, whether it's like multi-units or multi-family units, and just making those types of homes affordable to the general American public. That's really important too, because we see a lot of builds that are happening across the country that are for higher income earners, luxury standard. And I think it's also important that we're doing housing for all types of Americans at different income levels.
Yeah, somebody texted in and said nobody wants a starter home anymore, but maybe they're not building starter homes at 1,200 to 1,600 square feet.
Yeah, that starter homes, the lack of starter homes in our supply is certainly certainly a big barrier for a lot of Americans. And maybe it's also changing a little bit of our mindset around what is a starter home. Mm-hmm. Maybe it isn't the typical single family home anymore. Maybe it is more of an apartment, a condo, a townhouse, multi-unit type of building.
Thank you, Alex. I appreciate your time and your insights. Alex Gailey, Bankrate Data Analyst. When we come back, we're going to talk to Peyton Malone and talk about the visibility of the Northern Lights, believe it or not, here in this area at sunset tonight. We'll find out more about that. Then we'll talk to Dr. Fred Lopez about a measles outbreak. So a lot coming up. Stay with us. Tommy Tucker, WWL. You can text me 504-260-1870, our top of the mind survey. What's your lucky charm? Just don't overthink it. Just tell me. First thing pops to your mind, what is it that's a lucky charm for you? Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. All right, 7:39. Peyton Malone joins us now, WWL Louisiana weather forecaster, to talk about the Northern Lights. How you doing, Peyton?
Doing a little space forecasting.
Man, let me tell you, one of my bucket list items has been to see the Northern Lights, and I didn't know if I'd ever get to see them, but now it seems like they're coming to me. That's awesome. Tell me what's going on.
Well, the sun's been really active. It's had these CMEs, or coronal mass ejections. That's just highly charged particles being sent out from the sun racing towards Earth. And what's been interesting is we've had three in the past couple of days, and so we've had three separate solar storms moving at the Earth. The first two seem to have arrived last night, which is why we did see some of the Northern Lights all the way down here on the Gulf Coast. That third solar storm is expected to arrive at some point today, and if we can time it out just right and get everything just right, we may have another opportunity to see them later on this evening.
What would be the best time and the best way for us to see the Northern Lights here?
Well, the timing is a bit tricky because sometimes you don't know it's happening until it's actually happening, but it would be after sunset. So after probably 6 p.m. would be the best shot tonight, and the best place to see it would be away from the city lights. So if you can get far up on the North Shore, you have a much better chance of seeing it. You just have to look north. Now, a lot of times it's fairly weak down here, and I mean, this is super rare down here. And so you, a lot of times we'll have your long exposure on your phone camera. We'll be able to capture that red hue, but if it's strong enough, like it was last night, it'd get some reports that some people saw it with the naked eye up on the North Shore.
So we would see what exactly? Like a
red hue on the horizon is what it would look like down here. And it would be red in this instance. Further north, you start to get some of those greens and purples, and you can actually see it moving through the sky like ribbons. Down here, it's just that red hue on the horizon.
How further north?
Well, to see the big stuff.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
ARC Raiders, a multiplayer extraction adventure game where most of humanity shelters underground. But Raiders rise to the surface in search of something greater. In the Rust Belt, danger isn't the end of the story. It's the beginning of the adventure. Every journey above ground is a gamble against the relentless machines of ARK and rival raiders chasing the same dream. Explore a lethal yet vibrant world scarred by old conflicts and reclaimed by nature, where shifting conditions make every high-stakes run unpredictable. ARK Raiders.
Available now on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X, S, and PC. Rated T for Teen.
Ah, DSW, birthplace of the humble brag. Here, the shoes are so good, no one would ever know how little you paid. If you didn't go telling everyone, that is. And with never-ending options for every style, mood, and occasion, all at really great prices, we'll definitely give you something to brag about. So go ahead, stock up on fresh sneakers from your favorite brands. Or try those boots you always secretly knew you could pull off. Find the shoes that get you at prices that get your budget at DSW stores or at DSW.com. Let us surprise you.
At Marisa's, we're all about great jeans. You know, the ones that fit you just right. The ones that simply make you feel good. Because you don't just wear jeans, you live in them. Find great jeans starting at $29.90 in stores and at Marisa's.com.
You open the fridge, there's nothing there. So what's it going to be? Greasy pizza? Sad drive-thru burgers? Dish by Blue Apron is for nights like that. These are the pre-made meals of your dreams. At least 20 grams of protein, no artificial flavors or colors, no chopping, no cleanup, no guilt. Keep the flavor. Ditch the subscription. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Like in the central U.S., I mean, you go up into parts of, I mean, you get into Arkansas, Missouri, you could see it with the naked eye last night, but up into the Dakotas last night, I mean, it was incredible.
I don't think I have time to get there now. But
no, you don't.
No. Thank you, Peyton. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
It would be something to see. Even if you can just see a reddish hue, that would be something. Thank you, sir.
Happy Aurora hunting.
There you go. Peyton Malone, WWR Louisiana weather, Louisiana East Channel 4 weather forecaster. 7:41, 19 till 8. We'll talk about the measles when we come back with Dr. Fred Lopez here on WWL. 7:46, 14 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, quickly to Dr. Fred Lopez, professor of medicine in the section of infectious diseases at LSU Health New Orleans. How you doing, Dr. Fred?
Good morning, Tommy.
Tell me about what's going on with the measles here in Louisiana.
Well, as many people have heard, the third measles case was reported in Louisiana just recently. This is in addition to three last year. This person apparently went on an international journey, and nobody knows where, but likely was unvaccinated and came back with the measles and may have exposed some people at the airport in New Orleans.
So how do you go back and track this? You find out who has the measles, then the doctor diagnoses them with measles. They report it to the health department. Then the health department starts checking back to see where'd you go, what did you do, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's essentially it. The issue with measles is it's just so contagious. It's, you know, the estimate is that if you're not immune to the measles because you've not been vaccinated, because you've not had measles in the past, if you're around somebody with measles, 90% of people who don't have that immunity are going to develop the measles. So it's really contagious. And the virus can stay in the air for up to 2 hours after the person who's infected with measles has left a room or any area. And that makes it particularly contagious to people who don't have immunity against measles. So this is it's a public health issue. And I'm glad the health department has made an announcement about this individual so that if people have the potential for exposure, they can reach out to their healthcare provider and confirm that they've been vaccinated and are not going to develop measles if they've been exposed.
I was watching an old TV show the other day, and they were talking about the measles, and they were placing them under, they said, have you ever had the measles? No, well, you got them now, and they placed them under quarantine. Who is it that's immune to the measles at this point, doctor?
Well, it's anybody who's gotten the vaccine. It's a universally recommended vaccine. You're supposed to get it at 12 to 15 months of age, and then at 4 to 6 years of age. 93% protection with just one dose, 97% protective with two doses. So it's extremely effective vaccine. So if you've been vaccinated, you're immune to measles. Very few people are going to develop measles have been vaccinated. And even if you do develop measles after being vaccinated, the disease is much more likely to be milder in terms of its presentation and complications. Measles, you know, people just kind of disregard it because we don't see many cases any longer. But it does have complications. Diarrhea, ear infections are common ones, but the more severe ones might result in hospitalization, pneumonia, brain swelling, and about 1 to 3 out of every 1,000 people who develop measles will die from measles. And so this is a big concern. This year, more than 1,600 cases reported in the United States, the most since the year 2000 when measles was declared eliminated from the U.S. And many people may have seen just recently that Canada is no longer under the measles elimination category. They've had more than 5,000 cases in Canada this year, and it is no longer considered eliminated from Canada. So hopefully that will not happen here in the United States, but it's all about vaccination, and that's really what we need to promote because our vaccination rates have decreased, particularly during the era of COVID.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking about measles with Dr. Fred Lopez, professor of medicine in the section of infectious diseases, LSU Health New Orleans, 750, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:57, 3 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Dr. Fred Lopez, professor of medicine, section of infectious diseases at LSU Health New Orleans. A person with a case of contagious measles passed through Louis Armstrong Airport on Sunday. The health department checked that back to find that out. And now they're warning people if you were, I guess, Dr. Fred, who should be on the lookout for symptoms? How close would they have had to be and how contagious is measles?
Well, it's extremely contagious. As I mentioned, that if you're not immune to measles and you're around somebody who has measles, so let's say we take 10 people who are not immune, they're around somebody who's infected with measles, 9 out of those 10 people will develop the measles. So extremely contagious. And what makes it even more concerning is that the virus can stay in the air for up to 2 hours after that person has left a particular contained area, making it extremely likely that somebody who doesn't have immunity against measles is going to get infected. So anybody who may have been exposed to this individual should definitely reach out to their healthcare provider for further directions regarding whether they've been vaccinated appropriately or whether they need to be vaccinated or receive another intervention which can also protect them from developing the measles, which is the administration of immune globulin. So vaccine and immune globulin are protective measures for people who are not immune but who have been exposed to measles.
The measles are viral, not bacterial, so there's really nothing they can do once you get them, is there?
You're absolutely right, Tommy. It's primarily supportive care, getting people through the illness. And as I mentioned, because we don't see measles much anymore, people forget that this is a potentially deadly infection. 1 to 3 people out of every 1,000 who get infected with measles will die. And this used to be a much more common disease before 1963 when the advent of measles vaccine occurred in the United States. But prior to that time, 400 to 500 people died in the United States from measles each year.
Somebody wants to know, if you have measles, can you get the vaccine or is it too late?
If you have measles, probably too late to get the vaccine, although because then you're going to be immune after you get the measles. So having had the measles makes you immune thereafter, but too late. You want to reach out to your healthcare provider to see before you develop symptoms if you can get the vaccine or that immune globulin that I mentioned.
Thank you, Doc. I appreciate the information as always. Dr. Fred Lopez, professor of medicine in the section of infectious diseases at LSU Health New Orleans. We'll take a deep dive into crime when we come back with Ronald Serpas, as we always do on Wednesday morning. I also got our top of mind survey going, which is, what's a lucky charm? What do you consider your lucky charm? I'm getting some things in like horseshoes, lucky dice, casino chips, and rainbows. Text me, 504-260-1870. I'll tell you what the consensus is in the 9 o'clock hour. 8:15 now, joined by Ronald Serpas, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief, head of the Washington State Police, Nashville City Police, consultant to different departments, and you'll see him on TV as an expert every now and then, and he's nice enough to join us every Wednesday as we take a deep dive into policing and crime. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good Good morning, Tommy. Great to talk to you again today.
Thanks for taking the time. I want to start with this police officer. Thankfully, that is not life-threatening. It was shot in the leg this morning during a traffic stop. It goes to the nature of traffic stops. Now, none of these things are routine.
That's absolutely the case. It's a long-held statement in American policing that there's no such thing as a random traffic stop or a routine traffic stop, I should have said. Two police officers died while I was superintendent, one in Nashville and one in New Orleans, and both of them were engaged in a traffic function when they were killed. Mm-hmm. It's very dangerous.
Tell me about what people need to remember when they are pulled over for a traffic violation.
The simplest thing to do is just make sure you're not doing anything that looks agitated, that you're willing to engage the officer. The officer has a legal right to ask you questions. They have a legal right to see the proof of your insurance, the proof of your driver's license, and the proof of the registration. You'll see on the internet right now, there's a handful of people saying, well, I'm not answering anything. Well, the law provides that you have to give this information. Just turn it over. The other thing is this, Tommy, when I was chief in Washington, Nashville, and New Orleans, we took pride in the fact that we wrote tickets less than 30% of the time. Traffic enforcement to me was always about education. Stop people, say, hey, you're going 30 in a school zone. Think about the babies. Go on your way. Mm-hmm. The times that tickets actually become issued is because of reasons normally that the officer is limited by. Past citations for no license plate, not having a valid driver's license. And Tommy, it all boils down to this. If you get in a wreck this afternoon, you expect that the person who hits you has an insurance, has a vehicle that's registered, and their driver's license so that you can be made whole. So this notion that we hear sometimes that traffic enforcement is some sort of an oppressive social issue, it's not. It's to ensure that everybody who gets in a wreck knows who hit them, has insurance, and make me whole on the damage that was created.
Well, and not only that, but while I'm not a felon, if I'm breaking the law or doing something wrong or driving illegally, I don't have any right not to get pulled over. And besides that, it's a way for the police officers to find those that are lawbreakers and maybe have outstanding warrants, et cetera, correct?
Absolutely. In Washington State, for the 3 years I was chief, once every hour, someplace in the state of Washington, a traffic stop resulted in the arrest of a felon who was wanted by warrant, or it resulted in the recovery of illegal weapons, or it resulted in the arrest of someone trafficking narcotics. That was every hour on the hour for 3 years. Simultaneously, in Nashville, New Orleans, and Washington, double-digit decreases in the number of injury accidents. People having to go to the hospital, lose days of work, have a destruction to their body that might last the rest of their life. Traffic enforcement done well reduces injuries, reduces collisions, determines and fines people trafficking illegal activity. No question about it.
And I think, you know, as you say that, I realize that because there are no, quote, routine traffic stops. I can't imagine the officer's thrilled about having to pull you over either, is he?
No, I mean, one of the last things that happened in Nashville before I left, one of our sergeants pulled over a vehicle, somebody hiding in the backseat who had just escaped from Mississippi State Prison. Mm. The driver got the officer's attention, focused on him. The video camera watches the guy in the backseat crawl out under the sight line of the vehicle, come around, jump in front of the car, look the officer dead in his eyeball, and shoot him six times.
Mm. Mm.
And thank God Sergeant Chestnut survived, but he was lost for the rest of his life to be a police officer. Those are the kind of things that police officers know can happen because they do happen all around the country.
I want to take a break. We come back. I want to talk about what's going to happen with the Border Patrol. CNN reporting that the Border Patrol is going to move. Gregory Bovino, top Border Patrol official, is going to move from Chicago, maybe to North Carolina and then into New Orleans to separate that and distinguish it from the National Guard, which are two different things, and what it could look like here in New Orleans if the Border Patrol were to take up operations here or begin operations here. Now, that would interact with the local municipal law enforcement. I don't know, it would only be Orleans Parish because I think illegal immigrants are a problem in the metro area, not just in Orleans Parish. We're talking to Ronald Surpass, our friend, our guest, professor, practicing in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief, head of the Washington State Police, Nashville City Police. Did I say Washington State Police? NOPD? Yeah, he's been all over the place. Got jobs all over. He's been a police officer all his life. 820 traffic now, WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Ronald Surpass, our friend, who has been a police officer for all of his life and is now a professor practicing in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, also chiefs of some departments. Chief, let's talk about the Border Patrol, and if they do come to New Orleans, what would that look like, local interaction with local law enforcement? I say that because it's not just the city of New Orleans, I don't think, is it?
No, I mean, I just followed this on the newspaper probably as well as you do. It looks like it's a nationwide task force that they are moving around the country. They were in Los Angeles, Chicago. Now they're going to move to the east in North Carolina and into the New Orleans region, according to what's on the newspaper. The Customs and Border Patrol and its predecessor agencies have been in New Orleans since the 1800s with the Customs House and those type of activities. When 9-1-1 happened in the early 2000s, there was a massive change in reordering of the Department of Homeland Security to include the reordering of what used to be customs officers and now CBP. Long and short of it is local police officers are responsible to protect their citizens and to protect anyone who's going to be attacked. The Border Patrol would be wise, and I would say this publicly, if they're coming to any community, it would be wise for them to meet with the local law enforcement leaders to get an understanding of these transferred officers around the country to come here so that everybody knows where they are, everybody knows the playing field to try to reduce the numbers of injuries and all those kinds of things. I just haven't found enough information yet to know what exactly their intentions are here. And as recently yesterday, I think I read the DHS press person said, we just don't have the plans available for public presumption for public release yet.
So what does the law say if I'm driving around a big box store and I see people hanging around looking for work, even though I presume they're illegal, or maybe I presume they're not. I don't know what I presume. Can I presume anything, or what does the law say I can do or can't do?
Well, I think the law goes the other way. I think the law would suggest that persons can't work legally in the country if they're not legally allowed to work in the country. Mm-hmm. You're kind of a citizen minding your own business. You probably are not going to walk into the parking lot and say, can I see everybody's green cards, mm-hmm. which that's not even the word anymore, but it's everybody knows what it means. I don't know that citizens have as much of a duty to do that as the people who are there have a duty to be there legally. Citizens have some responsibility for hiring illegal. Remember, like I'm sure at your employer or other employers, you have to be verified by a national check system. The long and short of it is it's a mess, right? People are trying to make a living. People are trying to get work done. And understanding the differences in their legal status is fairly complex.
Do you think,
like, for example, Tommy, what if the person says, no, I am here legally? How are you going to challenge that information?
Right. Well, what can you do legally? That's what I'm saying. So as far as the border,
I don't know that you really can.
As far as the Border Patrol, I don't know what they do. Do they say, show me your papers? I mean,
well, if we believe, and there's evidence to believe two sides can be true at the same time. On the one hand, there was the announcement that they were going to look for illegal immigrants who had committed crimes, had orders of deportation, final orders of deportation, or had involved themselves in criminal behavior when confronted by federal authorities. And then there's another strain of thought that says they're just grabbing everybody on the street corners and not paying attention to the most violent people. I think that political debate is a debate on purpose for either side to make the best points they can. However, the law enforcement officers of the federal government do not have to ask anybody permission to enforce federal law. How they do that is the question. But they don't have to ask anybody permission to enforce federal law. If that's the case, how would the FBI investigate local politicians or police officers mm-hmm. for corruption? They would say, oh, we're going to come investigate you for corruption. You have to give us permission. No, that's not how it works.
So if you were the chief of the department of a local department, would you mm-hmm. welcome the Border Patrol coming in? Not that they're not here already, but enhanced Border Patrol presence?
I would want to know what the strategies were to make sure that our officers were safe, their officers were safe, and we were doing what we thought was our legal responsibility. Absolutely.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time as always. Ronald Sir, past professor, practice Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief. We come back. We talked to Aaron Mishler with NOFD about an event that's coming up to proceed NOFD, the fire department. Then we'll talk to Doug Cinceri, attorney and host of All Things Legal, about Brian Kelly and that mess at LSU over his buyout and what's probable cause and what's not and who owes who for what when. There are reports that Brian Kelly was offered a ton of money to walk away, and he refused that he wanted to be paid the full amount. So we'll see when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to the one and only Ian Ozan. 8:39, joined now by Aaron Mishler, who is the head of the president of the New Orleans Firefighters Union, and Damian Speranza, comedian hosting The Benefit, which is Comedy for a Cause. Good morning, gentlemen. How are y'all?
Good morning, Tommy. Doing good.
Tell me, Aaron, about the event.
Well, this is a benefit. This is its second year. Damien was gracious enough to put this together for us. It's a comedy event that's going to benefit the Firefighters Benevolent Fund. Damien's also a firefighter up in Connecticut, as well as a comedian. And he reached out to us last year to put on an event for us, and it went great. And he reached out to us again, and we're putting on another one.
When is it?
Tomorrow night at 7:30 at 5710 General Hague, which is the Firefighters Union Hall.
And tell me about the show, Damien, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely, man. It's something I do around the country when I'm not working at the firehouse. We have two amazing touring headliners, Joe List, who's been on The Late Show. I've been on Netflix. And then Sean Patton, who's actually from New Orleans, who's also done like Jimmy Fallon. He's got a TV show on FX called The English Teacher right now. You know, I'm going to be there. I'm hoping to surprise some people with maybe one or two more comics that aren't announced yet. But, you know, and then we always try to give, you know, a local comic or two time to grace the stage as well. So we had a great time, like I said, last year. A lot of laughs. The firefighters made, was it Jambalaya? Is that you guys made last year?
Jambalaya, we'll be making Jambalaya again this year.
So that'll be available. Yeah. Tickets are how much?
$30.
And how do you get them?
New Orleans Firefighters website, which is nolafirefighters.com. We have a link up on that page. Or you could go to our Facebook page as well.
Sounds like a great event for a great cause. Damien, how'd you get into comedy and firefighting?
So firefighting, I was having kids and I had always wanted to do something that made a difference. And, at the time I was working as a bounty hunter before then. So I wanted something where stability and that was, you know, something my kids could be proud of. So I ended up getting into that. And then, I had cancer like 7 years ago. I'd always wanted to do comedy and then I kept pushing it off 'cause I had bills to pay and kids to take care of. And then when I had the cancer and I beat it, I was like, well, what am I waiting for? Anything could happen tomorrow. So I just jumped in, and I've been pretty fortunate with the opportunities that I've had since then, and just wanted to give back to my brothers and sisters in the fire service and, you know, make the most of it.
All right, it's Comedy for a Cause. It's going to be a great show tomorrow night, 7:30 at the Firefighters Hall. Where's the address? At 5130 General Hague?
5710. 5710. 5710. Yeah,
I don't have the right.
5710 General Hague.
I don't have the right glasses on. Sorry, 5710 General Hague. Get your tickets how?
You can go to NOLAFirefighters.com. There's a link, or New Orleans Firefighters Facebook page.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both. Good luck. Hope it's a great show. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Doug Cinceri about Brian Kelly and LSU and that mess here on WWL. All right, 8:48, 12 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly to our friend Doug Cinceri, attorney and host of All Things Legal. How you doing, Doug?
Great. Good morning, Tommy.
Good to talk to you. Tell me what's going on with this Brian Kelly LSU mess and where the facts of the legal facts of the case stand.
Well, basically, LSU's doing contortions, trying to get out of a contract that now is bad, given Brian, you know, Kelly's non-performance and inability to meet expectations. So they're trying to figure out a way to get out of this contract or mitigate it. And it was not, you know, it wasn't necessarily contemplated that he would not win, but now that he didn't win to the extent he was supposed to, LSU is trying to figure out some way to reduce that $54 million buyout.
So let's talk about, first of all, as an attorney, if you were my attorney and I were to call you and say, hey, look, Doug, you know, the buyout's for $50 million, they're offering me $25 or $30 million. Including the elimination of mitigation and offset clauses to reduce a buyout if I get another job in football. Should I take the deal or not? What would you tell me?
Well, a lot of it's personal factors. It's, it's basically you're in a bad marriage. Do you want to stay in that bad marriage for the next 6 years, or do you want to cut and run and sever your ties with LSU? So it's more of a personal decision.
But they're saying $30 million just to leave, right? That's what they're saying?
Right,
it's like, look,
right,
here's $30 million, just go away. That's what they're saying, and he turned that down.
Right. Well, I think he's trying to improve the deal. And the way he's doing that is he's following what is called the declaratory judgment, trying to get the court in short order to declare that he wasn't terminated for cause. Now, both sides have something to lose if you go to court, because you're going to have the ugly underbelly mm-hmm. of college football. And also, there's maybe some behavior that Brian Kelly has that would not be appealing to him as a public figure. So you have those two considerations colliding. And it's just a matter of, you know, what's that threshold that both parties will agree to? Brian Kelly reportedly won't agree to 30, but it may be 35 or 40 million that he would agree to. Mm. But in order to get there, you have to take some type of aggressive action to get LSU to move off their position. So what you're basically doing is you're having some basic warfare to try to gain real estate that you don't have right now.
Let me take a break. I want to pick up the for cause thing, because you would think, and look, I'm not implying anything at all. Believe me, I'm not. But you would think if Coach Kelly had some in his background that would lead to termination for cause, he'd have taken the buyout and ran. So or the offer and ran. So we'll pick it up when we come back with Doug Cinceri. 8:51 now.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
ARC Raiders, a multiplayer extraction adventure game where most of humanity shelters underground. But Raiders rise to the surface in search of something greater. In the Rust Belt, danger isn't the end of the story. It's the beginning of the adventure. Every journey above ground is a gamble against the relentless machines of ARK and rival raiders chasing the same dream. Explore a lethal yet vibrant world scarred by old conflicts and reclaimed by nature, where shifting conditions make every high-stakes run unpredictable. ARK Raiders. Available now on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X, S, and PC. Rated T for teen.
Come to DSW for the shoes, stay for the fun. Because, let's be honest, if shoe shopping isn't fun, are you even doing it right? So go ahead, try something new. Try something different. Good different. Try something that feels like you. You know, the real you. And then definitely brag about it later. Because at DSW, you've got unlimited freedom to play. Find the shoes that get you at prices that get your budget at DSW stores or at DSW.com. Let us surprise you.
At Marisa's, we're all about great jeans. You know, the ones that fit you just right. The ones that simply make you feel good. Because you don't just wear jeans, you live in them. Find great jeans starting at $29.90 in stores and at Marisa's.com.
Why does every recipe I try need 18 ingredients, including a jar of something paste I'll never use again but will sit in my fridge for 9 months? I just want dinner in the oven, fast. That's why I love Blue Apron's new one-pan assemble and bake meals. They send you fresh ingredients that are already chopped. All you do is put it all together and bake. That's it. No chopping, no weird leftovers, just delicious, easy-to-make meals. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
9 till 9, traffic, WWL. 8:57, quickly back to Doug Cinceri, attorney, host of All Things Legal, talking about the Brian Kelly mess with LSU. Doug, when it comes to for cause, what does that mean?
That means that your contract is terminated without any further obligations based on a certain behavior that is defined in the contract, okay. A certain negative behavior. And basically, you're supposed to send a notice if you're going to be terminated by cause. And then, you know, presumably Brian Kelly would be able to respond to it. And also there's an argument as to if you do or terminate for cause based on a morals clause or some type of behavior that's prohibited, you're supposed to do that contemporaneously, not, you know, 3 years later, 2 years later.
I have a contract here that will, you know, if I get fired for moral turpentine, I think it is. Is that the phrase?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that, yeah. Anyway, moral turpitude. So, and I'm not alleging Brian Kelly did any of this at all.
Right.
But it would be odd that you would fire him for cause after he loses to South Carolina, after he loses to Vanderbilt. And who was the other loss after that? Texas A&M.
Yeah.
It would be odd that that's when you chose to fire him for cause, wouldn't it?
Yes. I look, it's an uphill climb for the LSU attorneys. I mean, they're sort of grasping, reaching, and trying to hold on to something to reduce the buyout. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically, LSU didn't want to terminate him with cause 2 weeks ago because they were in a state of indecision in how to deal with this. And they were in that paralysis has maybe foreclosed on certain options that they had for, you know, for cause. But and plus, they felt like if you send the notice, the program may be in a state of flux or a state of chaos for a month while this is being worked out between Kelly as he's coaching and LSU. So basically, LSU's got a very, very difficult legal strategy in being successful because that notice provision was not sent contemporaneously and it didn't set out what the behavior was or the violation of the contract.
Let me tell you what you said that I heard that made sense to me. You know, 25 to 30 was rejected. 54 is the number. There's some room in between there. I wouldn't be surprised to see this settled at like, 38, 40, something like that?
Right. They're going to do some more saber rattling, and it's probably going to be somewhere in between.
Yeah, that's what I would think as well. And I would guess, too, Doug, as a lawyer, you've seen people where it's some emotion evolved, and as time passes, maybe the emotion cools a little bit and cooler heads prevail.
Yeah, and LSU's got to raise the money also.
Yeah, so that too. That's the other part of it. Right, yeah. Thank you, Doug. Appreciate it as always, my friend.
Tommy.
Good to talk to you, Doug Cinceri. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Stephanie Regal about the Archdiocese, putting 150 parishes and others entities in bankruptcy. Thank you, Ian. Stephanie Regal joins us now, business writer for the Times-Picayune, NOLA.com, to help walk us through the bankruptcy situation with the Archdiocese of New Orleans. Good morning, Ms. Regal. How are you?
Good morning. How are you doing?
Can I call you Stephanie?
Please do.
Okay.
Of course.
Can I call you Steffi?
No.
Okay.
Only because I never went by that.
I didn't think so. I just thought I'd push it just to see, because that's what I do, Stephanie. Hey, let's talk about the Archdiocese. Take us, if you can, maybe to put all of this in context, just give us a little bit of background and then tell us where we are now.
So after 5.5 years of this bankruptcy case, more than 650 claims of clergy sex abuse have been filed, and the Archdiocese has been handling it through the bankruptcy court. This is really a mass tort case. They're trying to reorganize their finances to come up with an equitable way to financially compensate these abuse survivors. And it's been a long, drawn-out, messy process, but they now have a plan that has been agreed to by the survivors. 97% of them voted 2 weeks ago to approve it. It is approved by the creditors that do business with the Archdiocese. Obviously, the Archdiocese is behind it, and this and there is one significant group that is objecting to it, but we can get to that later if you want. But anyway, the big picture is this plan is now ready to go before the court to be confirmed. That will take place over a 10-day trial, basically, beginning next week before Judge Meredith Grable. And it'll have big people like the Archbishop and his financial advisors on the stand. We'll get to hear from clergy abuse survivors who will finally have their day in court and be able to tell their story. And we'll also hear from the group that I mentioned that is objecting to this, bondholders who are still owed some $30 million on a $40 million loan they made to the Archdiocese about 7 years ago. Now, as part of this process, 157 of the church's affiliated parishes and charitable organizations, which up until now have not been, quote, debtors or part of the bankruptcy, they've been independent, are going to be placed into Chapter 11 bankruptcy beginning today. So, you know, we previewed that in a story that I published Monday because we figured people are going to be freaked out, mm-hmm. you know, when they see their parishes are filing for bankruptcy. It's called a mini prepack bankruptcy. proxy process. It's not a new, you know, concept. It has been used in complicated corporate bankruptcies for a while, apparently. It is relatively new in these church bankruptcies, but the purpose is to basically quickly push the parishes and the other charities through the court in order to shield them from future legal exposure, from being sued by sex abuse claimants who maybe haven't come forward yet. In return, they are going to have to put up some money towards this settlement. The total settlement pot is roughly $230 million. The affiliates that are going to be placed in bankruptcy collectively will be on the hook for coming up with $60 million of that. And that's sort of the rub, because the church does things the way it does, it's not going to make public how much each parish or affiliate is going to be asked to contribute. What the church has said is that no significant, you know, amounts of parish donations will be used. No restricted funds that were made, like as charitable gifts, for instance, will be used. That no school tuition money will be used, and where the money comes from beyond that, we don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
We do know, I will say, they confirmed that in the case of Second Harvest,
I was getting ready to say,
which is one of their,
you're reading ahead, Stephanie.
One of their highest profile and most impactful charitable organizations, is not, I don't want to say they're not going to have to put up money. Legally, they are going to have to put up money.
But
an anonymous donor has agreed to cover their portion of it, whatever that is. And look, maybe anonymous donors have come forward to cover, you know, the tab for other affiliates as well.
So I'm a little bit confused about why are they putting the different parishes? Is it every parish that's being put into bankruptcy in the Archdiocese of New Orleans? Yes.
It's every parish and almost every charitable organization, which collectively we've been referred to as affiliates or apostolates, they're technically called. There are a few that will not be put into bankruptcy because they just absolutely have no potential for exposure, like the Catholic cemeteries, for instance. You know, I mean, nobody's going to come and sue dead people. Mm. And
well,
like,
but there would be
Catholic Community Foundation, which is literally a bank account. And so that's not to say that the foundation won't factor into this whole reorganization process, but they're not going to be placed into bankruptcy because it's not an organization with humans. It's just a fund, and you don't just put a fund in bankruptcy. So that all of that's, that's not, you know, to get far afield of this. That's just right. To explain that no, not every parish or charity will be, but it's the overwhelming majority of them. They're just a handful that are not.
I'm not trying to be indelicate here, but when it comes to cemeteries, there is the inherent value of the land. But I guess there's something about the law that says you can't foreclose on land, or once land is dedicated to be a burial ground, you can't evict the people that are there already, for want of a better phrase?
Well, I mean, I would imagine, you know, but I don't know. I mean, why would you liquidate the cemetery? You know, again.
Well, because it's valuable property, I would think, right?
Well, sure. I mean, and so is the seminary, maybe. I mean, a lot of the property is really not valuable when you're talking about what its liquidation value would be, you know? I mean, sure. Okay. There's a big cemetery on the edge of the French Quarter, prime real estate, you know, theoretically.
Again,
theoretically. Who wants to buy a cemetery deal with all of
who
that?
Wants it, and
I mean,
build,
right?
Right, and build on top of it and everything else. But when it comes let me take a break, Stephanie. We'll pick it up when we come back. Because I want to talk to you about the seminary building and all of that in the Archdiocese offices. How do you determine what gets sold off and what doesn't, and where the money's coming from? And I know you said there's some questions about that. I have a lot of questions myself. We're talking to Stephanie Regal, a talented reporter. I've been a fan of hers for a long time, business writer for Times-Picayune, NOLA.com, trying to walk us through the bankruptcy and what's happening in federal court, and could this finally mercifully be over for everybody. We'll pick it up when we come back on WWL. 9:23, Tommy Tucker, anxious to get back to Stephanie Regal because I know her time is limited and valuable and we appreciate it. So, Stephanie, let me ask you this. You look at the churches and you look at the schools and you look at the seminary headquarters, et cetera. If I'm, and I guess the bondholders that are not happy, that $30 million, those bonds preceded the bankruptcy, that bond sale, or did it not?
No, the bond sale preceded the bankruptcy.
It did, right. Okay, so.
It did. It was 2017. It was unsecured debt. And I can't tell you why, but like that's, you're kind of SOL. If you're unsecured debt in a bankruptcy, you know that. So, I mean, I'm sorry, but that is a risk that institutional investors face. And as a percentage of the total settlement, the bondholders payment, which is going to be 10% of what they're owed, computes out to roughly what the abuse survivors also will get, which is 10% of the value of a claim, which was, you know, valued by the financial consultants at, you know, something like $1.3 billion. And then the bankruptcy proposes paying 10% of that, which is $130 million, plus there's all sorts of other money that's getting thrown into the settlement pot. Now, I know that's very confusing, but what I'm just giving you the argument. Yeah. Bondholders, they might have a little, they can make some noise and they can try to negotiate for more than $3 million, but they don't really have that much of a leg to stand on. I can almost promise you they're not going to screw up this settlement.
Tim, look up the expression SOL for me, please. I'm sure it's some kind of Latin phrase or something that Stephanie used. I'm sure there's some kind of Latin background to that. So let me ask you this. When it comes to church properties, you know, I was talking about cemeteries before, but when it comes to parish facilities, those are protected under bankruptcy law, or because the church is only going to have to pay, the archdiocese is only going to have to pay 10% of the claims, they won't have to go into selling these things? I'm a little bit confused about that because...
No, I mean, they're going to sell properties. They already have sold properties. Some of the properties are owned by the individual parishes and affiliates. Some of the properties are owned by the mothership, the archdiocese itself, and we've seen the liquidation of those properties over the past few years. That's how I got into actually covering this as a business writer. The 1000 Howard Avenue, which is being converted to a hotel or something, allegedly. That's an example of one. A piece of parish-owned real estate that we've seen successfully transfer and undergo redevelopment is the Our Lady of Lourdes on Napoleon Avenue, and separately, the school next door, which was torn down to make way for a Trader Joe's. And those monies, by the way, are going towards the settlement. A huge piece of the settlement is coming from the sale of Christopher Homes, the low-income senior housing. That's going to throw another $70 million into the pot. And that's after debt to the federal government is paid off, HUD loans. So, no, real estate is being sold. Will there be more from the individual parishes? I would say yes, based on what the church has said. But I can't tell you how much. And
let me ask it this way.
With the cemetery example, though, I mean, like, why aren't they selling the seminary? Seriously? I mean, it's like...
The seminary or the cemetery?
Well, any of it. Okay. I mean, you mentioned the Notre Dame Seminary.
Yeah, let's talk about
before
that.
Before the break.
Right.
Well, why... I mean, look, this is a reorganization plan. It's not a liquidation.
Gotcha.
There is a document in the case called a liquidation analysis that shows what these properties would, you know, presumably fetch if they were sold. But we've talked about this before, too. There are churches and church buildings all over this town that nobody wants to buy. So, and this settlement has been agreed to. It's been agreed to, so it's sort of a moot point now. Like, we're not looking to sell Notre Dame Seminary anymore or the windows in the St. Louis Cathedral, which, you know, was proposed at one point last year when they first started negotiating. Everybody knew then that they wouldn't, but The survivors have voted on this plan. They're okay with it.
With the amount that and is up to be handed out, correct?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
So now it's
which is $230 million. It's going to be divided up. Some survivors are going to get more than others. But look at it this way. I mean, if theoretically, and it's not going to work this way, but if the 157 additional debtors, as we now call them, all contributed equally to, you know, the $60 million, that would, you know, that would only be something like $500,000 each. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the bar is really not that high. And I think you are going to see anonymous donors contributing. And I think they're going to find money from places that really aren't going to be terribly painful for, you know, the parishes and the other faithful in the town. I mean, you know, it's not easy. There's nothing about this that's been easy. But
at what point, Stephanie, just I know you got to go, but would all of this be over where the survivors are have gotten as much as they can get? The bondholders let it go. The archdiocese is out and Archbishop Amon says that's it and turns it over to the new archbishop. You have any idea?
Well, you know, there are going to be little strings that we're going to be tying up for a long time. Mm-hmm. But if the judge at the end of this trial, which runs through like December 2nd, mm-hmm. if she confirms the plan, then that's pretty much the final word.
Okay.
And if that happens, then the abuse survivors will begin to see money early next year. Now, the bondholders might appeal her ruling, so there will be that legal drama going on. This case has been strange from the beginning, but I would be really surprised if it completely derails the settlement.
Thank you, Stephanie. I appreciate your time and your patience. I really do. It's complicated stuff, but I know you are on top of it. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
You bet. Bye. 9:31, time for traffic now on WWL. 9:38, 22 till 9, joined now by one of the talented young reporters at WWL Louisiana, Alyssa Curtis, whom I had the pleasure of meeting at the, I think it was the Press Club Awards, wasn't it?
It was. It was a good time.
It was. How you doing? All right?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay. Before we get to the serious matter here, what grade would you give me for emceeing?
Oh, A+. That was great.
Yeah, that was nice. Thank you. Let's talk about, seriously, what's going on in Lafourche Parish. You've been all over this, and this is a mess. Tell me the story.
Yeah, a lot of people are really frustrated. I can just, you know, once we post on Facebook and do our stories, the amount of comments we get mm-hmm. is absolutely crazy.
Tell me what's going on.
So this happened in the beginning of the school year, but it seems to just be coming to light now because of the most recent Lafourche Parish school board meeting. So according to the lawyers in this situation and the meeting that happened on November 5th, there was an incident that was going on at Sixth Ward Middle School. The lawyers for one of the girls says that there were AI-generated nude photos of her going around and being circulated. They say the boys were kind of showing them to each other in school. So they essentially put her face on a nude body. And the lawyers say that she went and did everything she was supposed to. She went to school officials, the counselor, and said, hey, this is going on. And the lawyers say that they didn't take any corrective action. And by the end of the day, they put her on the bus with the boy who was circulating the photos. And they say that she just got to a breaking point, essentially. And on the bus, this boy was continuing to show these pictures, and she had enough. And there was some sort of physical altercation on the bus. After that physical altercation, she was expelled, seemingly because they have a zero tolerance policy. So she was expelled.
Let me slow you down a little bit. Mm-hmm. So just to understand this, the girl finds out that they're circulating, which, as I understand, and we'll get to that in a minute with Pat Connick and his law, that there was there were AI-generated fake nude photos of her being circulated around. She went to the authorities and reported this. They didn't do anything, and on that same day, they put her on the bus with the same kid that was still showing the pictures?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the lawyers and the school board both say that there was some sort of investigation into what happened. But the lawyers say it wasn't really an investigation, that it was very haphazard. They wouldn't allow her to call her dad, even though she requested to call a parent. They said, we're not involving parents at this time. So they said, yes, you say there's an investigation, but it wasn't, no corrective action was taken, no phones were confiscated, and you still allowed her to get on the bus with this boy. And of course, there, you know, the lawyers are saying, of course, she got to a point where she felt like she had nothing, she couldn't do anything else, and she wanted this to stop. So this, at the November 5th school board meeting, her lawyers came to before the school board and asked, you know, can this expulsion be reversed? This is not fair to her. You know, you guys failed her in how you failed to act. They eventually amended the expulsion. So she technically, the expulsion is still there, but she was allowed to come back to school immediately. And but she's on a probationary period. So it's unclear whether this expulsion will still be on her record and what that looks like, but she's not allowed to do extracurricular activities or anything like that. So there's still a lot of frustration here.
What happened to the kids who are generating the pictures or circulating the pictures that they generated?
So it's unclear who generated these photos, but the Lafourche Parish Sheriff's Office says that one boy involved in this incident was charged with 10 counts of unlawful dissemination of images created by artificial intelligence. And they do say that the investigation is ongoing and additional arrests and charges are possible. But during that school board meeting last week, the superintendent admitted on the record that this behavior was so pervasive, and there was, he says, at least half a dozen children were involved in this incident. So as this investigation continues and as we continue, you know, reporting on this, it could very well be that a lot of kids were involved in this. And we're even getting Facebook comments saying, you know, my daughter was involved in this, or there's more than just one victim in this case. So we're really trying to dig a little deeper and see what the extent of this behavior really is.
Tell me about Pat Connick and his law and what it says about AI generated photos.
So I'm not as familiar with this law. So we've been doing a little bit of breaking up this coverage because it's such a huge story.
Sure.
But looking at the reporting that my colleague Mike McDaniel did, Pat Connick said to him, AI is coming at us very fast and furious. And in this case, the bill works. So it became law after the 2024 legislative session. So it's a very brand new law. And he essentially says, we saw, you know, what could happen with this, and it's moving so fast. So it seems like, just, you know, I'm not as familiar with this law as Mike McDaniel is, but it seems like they just really want to get a hold of this specific behavior and, you know, the damage that AI generated images can do. Especially, you know, it seems these kids are so young. It seems like they don't really know the extent and, you know, what the damage of these artificial intelligence images can do. So it really seems like they really want to just get a hold of the bad things that can happen that come out of artificial intelligence.
So what happens next, Alyssa?
It's kind of unclear. It's been really hard to get any information from officials on this story because it does involve juveniles. So we know now that some boy is charged with this law, he's eventually going to have to go before a judge. And, you know, I imagine a court proceeding as the process goes on with these charges. Lafourche Parish Sheriff's Office also says the investigation is ongoing. So it seems like they really want to get to the bottom of who created these images, if there were more children circulating these images. It's unclear on the school side what is happening. They've sent me a few statements saying that essentially they did what they were supposed to. They said the evidence suggests that the school district did in fact follow all of our protocols and procedures. They also say that this case, like we mentioned, the case was brought to law enforcement immediately. So there's still a little bit of gray area here about what happens next, but there's some sort of criminal justice aspect to this, and we know it has to go through the courts at this point now.
You know, as a parent, it just seems to me as though the school system failed this young lady terribly in so many different ways, and now she's still being punished, right?
Yeah, that's what her lawyers are arguing, that, you know, and through the lawyers, the family has told me that, you know, while what the boy did was not great, it was not a good action, you know, they really do want to focus on the adults in this situation. And they feel that that's really where all of this whole situation was really born out of and was the root of this issue. They say that she did everything she was supposed to, counselors, teachers, and they say that teachers and these people in schools are supposed to protect these children from situations exactly like this, and they didn't hear her, they weren't taking the corrective action. So the family is really focused on the failures and the alleged failures of the adults in this situation, and that's where they feel like this all stems from.
So as I understand it, the amount of the physical altercation was, it's not as though she took a baseball bat to the kid or anything, which if it was my kid, I'm not one to advocate that kind of thing, but emotionally it can get to you. But all she did was swatted the phone out of his hand, right?
Yeah, so we got part of a video that shows part of the incident, and the lawyers admit that there is a longer version of a video from the surveillance cameras that were on the school bus. They do not have access to this. We have not been successful in obtaining this video. But the video that we do have shows that the boy was showing pictures to someone next to him on the school bus. And you can hear in the background, you know, there's chit-chat and kids on the bus. So it's hard to make out what they're saying. Mm-hmm. But she says, you know, stop it. Am I the only one who's going to do something here? And she swats at him and she hits him in the head. What I saw wasn't a punch. It wasn't, you know, pummeling of this kid. The way that the school board described it, though, in that November 5th meeting was much more violent. It seemed like it had escalated much further than this. The lawyers say, though, that what we saw on the video that we have is much of what happened throughout the rest of the incident. So they say it didn't escalate much further than that. So there's still somewhat of a gray area that we're, again, trying to figure out and trying to get that video from the school bus.
Are there some kind of undercurrents here, Alyssa, that maybe might exist that are not coming to the forefront?
Yeah, there seems, just, you know, talking to the community and looking at, again, the comments that we're getting.
Because it makes no sense is why I'm asking you this. It makes no sense.
Yeah. It seems like we're missing part of it. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of the community feels this way, that there must be something else that we're missing. But looking at, you know, again, our comments and stuff, they're saying that this has happened before, it seems like. And a lot of parents feel like adults at this school and the school district have not been protecting the kids. So again, we're really trying to dig here and see what happened and why it seems like no corrective action was taken, but then the finger pointing turned to this little girl.
Everybody's got a story. What made you want to become such a journalist? Because you really are, and that impresses me about you. What is it that makes you want to do that?
I think I've always just been really curious. And then, you know, starting in this industry and learning what this industry was, just talking to people. I really love talking to people and helping them and getting to the bottom of, you know, whatever story it is that I'm looking into, where does this stem from? What's really going on here? And I like to look for the truth. So I think that's what I always strive for, and the truth and to be fair.
Do you ever find yourself talking to yourself inside of your head, because I do, about really what is absolute truth?
Yeah, a lot of times. And yeah, sometimes, you know, you're at your desk and you're looking at a story and you're spending so long on it, you know, you're saying, you know what, let me go take a walk, clear my head.
Right, exactly. But wait a minute, but this, but that, but if that, but wait,
yep,
but that, and that. I got you. You do a great job, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. You too. Alyssa Curtis, WWR Louisiana reporter, 950, 10 till 10. Quick break, then we'll find out what Newell's got planned for us today here on WWL.
ARC Raiders, a multiplayer extraction adventure game where most of humanity shelters underground. But Raiders rise to the surface in search of something greater. In the Rust Belt, danger isn't the end of the story. It's the beginning of the adventure. Every journey above ground is a gamble against the relentless machines of ARC and rival raiders chasing the same dream. Explore a lethal yet vibrant world scarred by old conflicts and reclaimed by nature, where shifting conditions make every high-stakes run unpredictable. ARC Raiders,
Available now on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X, S, and PC. Rated T for Teen.
I'm caught up in the game. My attention is on every play and every whistle. But what I'm missing is a signal coming from my kidneys. That signal isn't like a ref's whistle. It's more of a silent SOS, which could be warning me of an increased risk for events like heart attack or stroke. And a way I can catch that signal? A simple urine test called UACR. If you have type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure, talk to your doctor about the UACR test. Detect the SOS. Visit detectthesos.com to learn more.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You think you understand how this business works, but you don't.
Landman, TV's biggest phenomenon, returns to Paramount Plus. From Taylor Sheridan, co-creator of Yellowstone, starring Billy Bob Thornton.
You have to know the rules of the game and bend them. And you really have to know them to break them.
Demi Moore.
I want success. Get it for me.
Andy Garcia, Ali Larter, and Sam Elliott.
You don't even know the game you're playing, do you?
Landman, new season, streaming November 16th, only on Paramount Plus.
Heather is a nurse practitioner from UnitedHealthcare.
We meet patients wherever they live.
During a house call, she found Jack had an issue.
Jack's blood pressure was dangerously high.
It was 217 over 110.
So they got Jack to the hospital and got him the help he needed.
He had had a stent placed in his heart, preventing a massive heart attack.
If it wasn't for my guardian angel, I wouldn't be here.
Hear more stories like Jack's at unitedhealthcare.com. Benefits, features, and/or devices vary by plan. Area limitation and exclusions apply.